Welcome to Interleaved, where we take a deep dive into topics from the Daf Yomi with modern-day sages of the Torah and the world. I'm Natanael Zelis-Palay. On today's episode, the family ties that bind.
If we were sociologists or anthropologists, we would say, what must it be like to marry to somebody who used to be your brother-in-law? Wow, that's weird.
Gone are the lighter discussions of the details of the Jewish holidays, and the frequent, much-appreciated interruptions of agadic and philosophical material. From now until July, we will study Masechet Yevamot, a vast and unforgivingly complex tractate that deals with the laws of Yibum, or levirate marriage, the obligation of a brother to marry the wife of his deceased brother. To ease our way in, we have the privilege and pleasure of learning from one of the foremost experts on levirate marriage and rabbinic law, Rabbi Dr. Dvorah Weisberg. Rabbi Dr. Dvorah Weisberg is the Rabbi Aaron D. Pamkin Professor of Rabbinics at Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion, Rabbinical School, and Director of the Rabbinical Program in Los Angeles. Dr. Weisberg is the author of Levirate Marriage and the Family in Ancient Judaism, which explores the ancient rabbi's understanding of family and familial relationships. She also teaches frequently in informal settings, including adult education programs and congregations, several summers at the URJ Kala, and sessions for the CCAR and its regional conventions. Dvorah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's so great to have you. I'm so excited for our conversation. So before we get into the nitty-gritty, the particulars of levirate marriage, Yibum, and the rabbinic idea of the Jewish family in general, what brought you to study this topic?
I came at this backwards. I was teaching Biblical Hebrew, and I was teaching my students the Book of Ruth. And when we got to the last chapter of Ruth, I wondered, wow, you know, what more should I know about this kind of strange marriage? So I went back to Genesis and to Deuteronomy, and I was really surprised. I would have thought that it would be the men in the families who would be pushing for this, since it really maintains the sort of male lineage, but it wasn't. It was the women. The men were all resisting. And as a Talmudist, I had never studied Tractate Yevamot before, but I said to myself, wow, I wonder what the rabbis do with this. Do the rabbis make something of this reluctance of men to enter into these marriages that apparently advantage them and the eagerness of women to promote them? So I went and started studying Mishnah Yevamot. And boy, that was really a surprise.
Wow, yeah, that's a really interesting question that we'll definitely get into, but a really impressive undertaking considering Yevamot is one of the three most difficult tractates in the Talmud, according to, you know, a very kind of, popular conception promoted in, you know, the yeshivot of Eastern Europe. But yeah, that's really, really interesting. So to provide some background for our listeners before we dive in, how is the commandment of Yibum, or levirate marriage, described in the biblical text? And how does the rabbinic understanding depart from this description?
Deuteronomy 25 is really, I think, very straightforward. It says that when brothers live together and one of them dies, that his widow shouldn't marry outside the family, but should marry his brother, who's often referred to as the levir, the brother or the brother-in-law, and that their first child should be accounted to the deceased so that his name shouldn't disappear from Israel. And that if the brother doesn't want to marry the widow, he is forced into this ritual where he is publicly shamed for his disloyalty to his brother. So that's what we know from the Torah. I want to say from the start that the rabbis turn this on its head, that what they call levirate marriage doesn't look at all the way levirate marriage looks in the Torah or in any of the other cultures that practice levirate marriage. And I found out there were many. Instead, the brother can marry his sister-in-law or not. If he does marry her, the children of their marriage are his children. They're not accounted to the deceased. They don't receive the property of the deceased. That goes to the brother. He gets the property with the widow. And if he wants out, he does this ritual of release described in the Torah called chalitza. But the rabbis make it a non-shaming ritual. They make it less sort of physically abusive. She doesn't spit right at him. And they're clear that they're just as comfortable with the release as they are with the levirate marriage itself. There's no social shaming. So essentially, they've pretty much changed it massively while still calling it Leveret.
Thank you for that introduction. Really helpful. So in the introduction to your book, Leveret Marriage and the Family in Ancient Judaism, you argue that the sages believe the primary family unit in Jewish law and life is the nuclear family. In other words, father, mother, and children. Why is this significant? And how does it explain their approach to the institution of Yibum?
I think that it relates to Leveret because Leveret very much assumes an extended patrilineal family living together where brothers have shared interests. They live together, they work together, they own property together perhaps. And under a situation like that, you can understand why the Torah would expect that a man would marry his sister-in-law, even if he had no desire to do so, right? As an obligation to his kin, to his clan, to his brother. But when you start to think about the family primarily as a married couple and their children, as the rabbis would have it, then you can see why Leveret became more problematic and why the rabbis were willing to change it. This focuses much more on the individual, and obviously mostly the individual man, and what he wants, his wife, his children, which makes it understandable that you wouldn't want to demand that a man father children for other people, namely his brother. So I think those two things reflect each other. That is, Leveret makes a lot more sense and is practiced much more in societies that have extended patrilineal clans than in societies that are more urban, that are more differentiated, and where people think of themselves first, not their obligation to their extended family.
That's so fascinating. Though the order of the tractates is likely a technical matter, it is nonetheless worth discussing the significance of the fact that Seder Nashim begins with a tractate about an institution that was designed to control the fate of women. As you noted in your introduction, and as you just noted before, the discussion is complicated by the fact that two prominent women in the Bible, Tamar and Naomi, endorse the practice of Yibum, while their male relatives resist it. How can we approach these texts in a way that is both consistent with contemporary understandings of gender and gender equality, but simultaneously honest about the realities of life in the ancient world?
I think that when we study ancient texts, and in my case, mostly the Talmud, we have to hear the voice of the text. We have to recognize that the text was produced by certain people in a certain place and time, and it spoke to a large extent to their reality. That being said, once we've tried to hear the voice of the Talmud, we've tried to understand their culture, we're not required to embrace it wholeheartedly. I can appreciate what the Talmud says about the family without wanting to make my family look like those families. So I think that's obviously the sort of wide, comprehensive answer. One of the things that I really liked about those stories in the Bible where women pushed men into doing Leveret or something like Leveret is that it reminds us that the biblical authors and later the rabbis as well understood that there were women who had agenda of their own, and that women used whatever tools were at their disposal to press their agendas, even if they socially, economically, politically had less power. So I think that there are redeeming moments in many texts, but I also think it's important not to force people. I don't want to push people into the Talmud and say from the beginning, you have to appreciate this, or this has to have meaning for you. Because I think that there are texts that will have meaning for people and texts that won't. And to force someone to find meaning in something that disturbs them feels really kind of aggressive to me and not the way I would want to teach or study.
Such a thoughtful and wise answer. Thank you. Yeah, that really speaks to me as well. Just my understanding of meaning in religious life. So let's dive into the daf. The tractate begins with a Mishnah that lists 15 women who exempt their tzarot, literally competitors, but here referring to co-wives of the deceased brother from Yibum. These women exempt their co-wives because they themselves have a familial relation to the living brother who would otherwise be obligated in Yibum. Before we pick apart this Mishnah, one of the longest and most complex opening Mishnayot in the entire Talmud, Our listeners may know that the Mishnah and its more expansive sister text, the Tosefta, were produced in Roman Palestine, or the Land of Israel, at the end of the 2nd and beginning of the 3rd century. What do we know about levirate marriage from these texts, and what, if anything, do they tell us about Jewish family life at the time, including influences from its Roman context?
So the first Mishnah in Yevamot, which requires a major family chart in order to keep track of all the players, and is probably the reason that one of my teachers advised me never to study it, actually gives, I think, probably a very false picture of Jewish life in Roman Palestine, because it leads us to assume that everybody is polygamous. And in fact, there's no reason to believe that was true. We know that Greco-Roman culture was monogamous, that however many sexual partners a man might have, he only had one legal wife. And while we believe that it's possible that some Jews did practice polygamy or polygyny, marriage of one man to more than one woman, in Roman Palestine, we don't believe that it was the norm. We don't believe that most men had more than one wife. And yet the Mishnah is talking specifically about a case where a man is married and that one of his wives is related to his brother beyond or above and beyond the fact that she's his sister-in-law. So in that sense, it's probably leads people to believe things about family life in Roman Palestine that were not really the way most people lived.
Yeah, that's definitely, you know, kind of heavily implied if one learns the Mishnah without, you know, knowing that context. And can we glean anything else from, like, about the attitude of the rabbis, you know, of Roman Palestine towards Yibum?
I would say a lot. I think when you read the Mishnah, what really struck me was that while the rabbis talk about levirate marriage a lot in this tractate, obviously, I don't feel like they're heavily invested in levirate marriage. I feel like it's at best to take it or leave it. You know, you could do levirate marriage if you could possibly meet all these conditions, which we have set down. But, you know, we would be just as happy if you did chalitza. And you, the man in question, would benefit just as much because you would still get a share of your brother's property, even if none of you, neither you nor your other brothers, wanted to marry her. And I think that probably comes out of the fact, two things. First, that monogamy was the norm and levirate marriage works best in societies that are polygamous, where if your brother dies leaving a childless widow, when you are already married, you could still take her on. And secondly, I think that this was not the primary, what Jack Goody calls strategy of continuity practiced in the Greco-Roman world. When a Roman man and his wife didn't have a child and they wanted to find an heir, they adopted someone. And they usually adopted an adult, by the way, because then you know what you're getting. In the Greek world, if you had a daughter and no son, you married your daughter off to someone else in the extended family who you liked a lot, and your grandchildren became your heirs that way. This notion that the thing to do is to produce a child posthumously after the death of a childless man and say, we're going to treat this child legally as the child of someone who was dead before this child was born, is completely outside the realm of possibility in the Greco-Roman world. And we know that Jews were influenced by the cultures and the norms under which they lived.
Yes, that's something really interesting I noticed in reading the introduction to your book.
I think that the most interesting line in Yevamot, in the Mishnah, that helps us understand what the rabbis were doing is in chapter 4. I'm not going to stake my reputation on remembering which Mishnah, but it says, if he marries her, that is, if the brother-in-law does marry the levirate widow, his sister-in-law, she is like his wife in every way, except that her ketubah, her marriage settlement, is a lien on the estate of her first husband. So that statement, she is his wife in every way, I think really is the difference between levirate marriage in rabbinic Judaism and levirate as it's practiced in many other cultures. In many other cultures, the woman, in fact, is never her brother-in-law's wife in the formal sense. she's still married on some level to her deceased husband. The children are his. The property goes to the children that are accounted as his. Here, the brother, if he marries the widow, inherits his brother's property, and becomes her husband, and the children that they have together are his children, legally, hopefully biologically as well. And so that encapsulates what's going on. And moreover, by the way, it explains why the rabbis are completely uninterested in this marriage once it's made. They have no interest in discussing children of levirate marriages and whether they're different than any other children, whether a levirate marriage operates on any different understandings, which we might wonder about. I mean, if we were sociologists or anthropologists, we would say, what must it be like to marry to somebody who used to be your brother-in-law? Wow, that's weird. You know, what's it like to know that your parents only got married because your mother's first husband died and they were obliged to get married? The rabbis could not care less about that. The day that either chalitza, the ceremony of release, or yibum, the levirate marriage, takes place, the rabbis are done. They could care less. And I think that's a really interesting thing.
That's so fascinating, especially given, like, you know, the biblical reasoning or motivation for the commandment, the mitzvah. How do you think the rabbis squared that understanding with the biblical understanding?
Yeah. I think that, you know, the rabbis are extremely gifted at creating a Judaism for their own world and then insisting that it's the Judaism that God intended. Right? That, I think, is the purpose of the various midrashim that they use, both in rabbinic literature that we've talked about, and also in Sifrei Devarim, in the midrash that talks about Deuteronomy in the Tannaitic period. They are expert at convincing themselves, and hopefully their readers, that this is what the Torah intended. But I think that what they have done masterfully is to create a system that allowed them to preserve levirate in name, so they don't appear to be throwing the Torah out, while creating a system that worked for the people who they were living with. And I think that that's one of the reasons that Judaism has survived so long, is because we've always been able to interpret it in a way that preserved our sense of connection to the past, while allowing us to live in the present.
Yeah, I think that really highlights something I think about a lot. Just the fact that I think a lot of people, you know, myself included, don't really appreciate how flexible the rabbis were in adapting, you know, the understandings of the biblical text, you know, and how much they really were open to change, to like newness, as, you know, contrary to at least, you know, understandings of halakha, of rabbinic law that I grew up with. It also fascinates me that the tractate begins not with a description of the cases in which one is obligated in Yibum, but a description of cases in which one is exempt. It's almost as if the rabbis are, knowingly or unknowingly, revealing an underlying tension between the biblical commandment and their own attitudes toward it. And in fact, you argue that these attitudes shifted based on the cultural context in which different generations of rabbis found themselves. In particular, you note the differing approaches of the rabbis of the Palestinian Talmud, who lived in Roman Palestine, or the land of Israel, versus the rabbis of the Babylonian Talmud, who lived in Sasanian Babylonia. What were these approaches, and how were they perhaps influenced by their respective sociocultural environments?
So I want to say that the rabbis are always aware that levirate marriage is strange, because they say that God gave two commandments simultaneously. One was to avoid incest with your brother's wife, and the other was a commandment to perform levirate marriage, which is, of course, marriage with your brother's widow. And so that tension exists throughout rabbinic literature about levirate marriage. I think that the cultural issues that we can see in the differences between the Palestinian rabbis and the Babylonian rabbis are reflective of, again, the strategies of continuity, the ways that people got heirs, and also the ways they constructed marriage and sex in the two communities. So again, the Greco-Roman world was, generally speaking, a Greco-Roman monogamous. And it's very difficult to do levirate marriage in a monogamous society on an ongoing basis. Also, they didn't think that the person who inherited your estate had to be your blood kin. You could adopt someone, which didn't exist in rabbinic Judaism as a formal thing. In Babylonia, there was much more emphasis on a man having a child of his own or a child by his wife. And so we see things like levirate marriage in Sasanian Babylonia, in the law of this period, which even allow a man to, forgive me, lend his wife to somebody for the purposes of getting her pregnant. And the principle is, it was quite crudely expressed in the terms like, basically, if you own the field, you own what grows in the field, no matter who plants it there. You then take your wife back, and the child is raised as your, is understood legally to be your child because it was given, your wife gave birth. So you can understand why, if that's the background, levirate doesn't look so crazy. And so we see the Babylonian rabbis not insisting on levirate marriage, but saying that it's preferable to chalitza, while their Palestinian counterparts said precisely the opposite, that releasing your sister-in-law was preferable to levirate. Neither of them outlawed either of these options, but there's clearly a preference for one versus the other.
Yes. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we see this actually on just the second page of the tractate. Abba Shaul, who I believe was the Palestinian Amora, he says, mitzvah halitza kodemet le mitzvah yibum. So the commandment of halitza comes first. We encourage people to, the brother-in-law, to do that before yibum. You know, that's really interesting to see on only the second page of the whole tractate. Another thing I find fascinating, and this is something you alluded to, about the first Mishnah and the ensuing Gemara, is that it gets right at one of the core paradoxes of yibum. All of the relationships listed in the opening Mishnah are biblically forbidden because of familial relation, and yet yibum itself overrides the prohibition of marrying one's brother's wife. The Talmud is aware of this paradox and says on 3b that all of these prohibitions would similarly be overridden by the commandment of yibum if not for a single word in Leviticus 18:18, from which the rabbis derived the 15 aforementioned exemptions. The implication is that the Torah set very few, if any, restrictions on levirate marriage, and the rabbis were the ones to limit it. What do you think this tension says about how the rabbis understood the concept of the Jewish family in contrast to the Torah?
So first of all, I want to say that I don't really think that the Torah, in saying that you should marry your childless brother's widow, imagined or meant that would be true, even if it meant you were marrying your sister or, you know, or your aunt or whatever. I think that the commandment of levirate in Deuteronomy isn't discussed at enough length to make any kind of assumptions about what it meant. But I do think that for the rabbis, they're quite aware that marrying one's brother's widow, even if it's permitted by Deuteronomy, and even if Deuteronomy overrides Leviticus if there are no children, and only if there are no children, it feels weird. I think it feels incestuous, even if it's not. It's kind of like when people were raised in the same children's house on kibbutz. They weren't actually related, but what we know from sociologists is they felt as if they were siblings and did not find each other romantically interesting. I think that that first Mishnah is almost the rabbi's way of saying, really trust us, levirate under the proper circumstances isn't incest, because see, if we thought it was incestuous, we would tell you you couldn't do it. So it's almost, you know, the lady doth protest too much. Their insistence of what is incest and how we would make sure that you will not perform levirate if it feels incestuous is, I think, also their way of saying, if you do find yourself in a position where levirate is appropriate, don't freak out. It's okay. It's not incest. Oh, and by the way, if you want, you don't have to do it anyway. You can just do chalitza. So I think that tension is really present in that first Mishnah.
You devote a chapter of your book to the status of the levirate widow, or Yevama, a woman to whom the obligation of Yibum applies when her husband dies. As you note, the Yavama is in a precarious position because due to her lack of children, she no longer has any blood ties to her deceased husband's family, and yet is still a candidate to re-enter that family. Of course, however, that itself is dependent on the decision of her brother-in-law to marry her or perform chalitza. What can the unique position of the Yavama tell us about how the rabbis understood unmarried women, and in particular their social mobility and familial relationships?
I think there's no question that the Talmud assumes that women would rather be married than single. It was, after all, written from the male perspective, so I'm not sure that that is true, but they certainly believed it. I think that the Torah portrays the childless woman, widowed or married or single, right, as having a lower social status than a woman with children. I think that it probably continued to be an unfortunate thing for a married woman to not have children in the rabbi's world, since children seemed to be such a desideratum, and since men believed, presumably, that they had an obligation to reproduce. But we also know from the studies that people like Michael Sattlow have done that widow remarriage, divorcee remarriage was more socially acceptable in the rabbinic period than not. And therefore, I think it's possible that a childless widow, particularly a young childless widow, might have been less of a social liability in the rabbi society, more likely to be able to find a husband on her own than the Torah imagines it, which again, may be why they were more comfortable with chalitza, because they didn't feel like these women were going to be, you know, out starving in the streets. Obviously, the woman is at a real disadvantage here. The Mishnah is clear that levirate marriage can be performed even through an act of rape. That is, if a man can solemnize, right, formalize a levirate marriage by having intercourse with his brother's widow, even if she doesn't consent. So we can see how little power women had, according to the Mishnah, if their brothers-in-law wanted to marry them and they weren't so enthusiastic. And we also know that the rabbis expect the man to make the decision. A man, even if a woman perhaps wanted to marry her brother-in-law or didn't, the decision was his. That's why I'm particularly interested in the texts in the Babylonian Talmud, where the rabbis describe stories where a levirate widow comes to a rabbi and says, "My brother-in-law wants to marry me, and I don't want to marry him." And instead of saying what the Mishnah would tell the rabbi to say, which is, "My dear, it's really not your choice, it's his," the rabbi says, "Why not?" And the woman gives her reasoning. He thinks I'm attractive. He just wants the money. I don't trust him. And the rabbi fools the man into doing chalitza. For who? Right? I mean, you could say that the rabbi thinks this would be a terrible marriage and it's not a proper use of levirate, but he's also helping the woman. And so to some extent, those are examples where women assumed agency, and instead of saying no, the rabbi supported them for whatever reasons. So I think that levirate marriage is not set up in the Mishnah as something that women have much say over, but there are hints in the Talmud that women tried to take control of their lives when they could, and that sometimes they had male allies.
Were there stories in which they did not have those allies?
I mean, those aren't the stories the rabbis tell us. I'm sure there were occasions like that. But it is interesting that the Talmud describes the advice, I think it's chapter 12, that rabbis could give couples that were contemplating levirate marriage versus chalitza, versus the release. And they say, you know, you might say to the man, "She's so much older than you," or "You're so much older than her." Or, so in other words, they don't really seem invested in levirate marriage as an institution. I think they're open to it if it's what this particular man or possibly this particular couple want, but they don't have a stake, not like Judah in chapter 38 of Genesis, or Tamar for that matter, trying to make sure this happens. There's not that emotional investment in the institution that's assumed in the Bible.
And I think it might also be worth mentioning here the kind of principle. I don't know exactly how and where it's applied, but it's kind of the rabbinic corollary to the biblical principle, lo tov hayod hadam levado, it is not good for man to be alone. And the rabbis say, tav lemeitav tandu milemeitav armelu?
Yes, about women.
Right. So it's better to be, coupled, in a relationship with someone else than it is to be a widow. And I don't know much else about how that principle is applied, but.
Well, I mean, it's almost a folk saying, but I think it's important to remember that given the fact that the rabbis assume that widows can remarry, that means that if the brother releases his sister-in-law, he's not necessarily releasing her to eternal widowhood. He's releasing her to collect her ketubah, right, to collect her marriage settlement. And if she wants to get remarried, to go ahead and get remarried to someone outside the family. You know, I think those of us who are married and love our families and love our families by marriage don't necessarily look at our brothers-in-law and think, oh, well, I could have just as well married one of them.
Another chapter of your book concerns the child of a levirate marriage. They too are in a precarious position because in order to fulfill the biblically stated goal of yibum, they should be assigned to the deceased brother's family. And yet halachically, they become a part of the living brother's family. Their status thus becomes a central question in the rabbi's mission to maintain Jewish continuity. How does this question figure into the rabbi's discussion of levirate marriage in the tractate?
So the rabbis take it for granted that the child of a levirate marriage is the legal child of the woman's second husband. And in that sense, the child's status is quite clear. The levir, the brother-in-law who's married the widow, presumably inherits the estate of his deceased brother. And if he dies sometime in the future, the children of this marriage, and by the way, if he had another marriage as well, right? All of his children inherit whatever they would inherit because he's their father. They don't get more if they're the child of the second marriage, if the first brother left a lot of money. The rabbis seem most interested in a situation in chapter 4, where unfortunately, the child, you're supposed to wait 3 months after the death of a woman's husband before she remarries, so that if she's pregnant, we know exactly who the father is. So they discuss, and that's even more important with levirate, by the way, because if she's pregnant, there's no, and the child is born, there is no levirate. So they say, what happens if the brother-in-law and the widow go ahead and get married too quickly before that 3 months? And then it's clear that she's pregnant and we don't know who's the father, the deceased or the brother. And of course, they didn't have, because DNA might not have been very useful with two brothers, but they had no way to determine paternity. So they say this child is, status is unclear. It's not clear who their father is. It's also not clear now whether levirate was even necessary. And they imagine scenarios where years later, when the older generation is dead, sons from the levirs, the brother-in-law's other marriage, say to these ones, well, they have arguments about who was your father, because that will decide who's getting the most money from the estate. If they were the children of the first marriage, they should get only that money. If they were the child of the second marriage, then everybody splits the pot. It's clear that this is the worst possible position to be in when you don't know who your father is. You don't know whether your father is your uncle is your father or whatever. And that's a nightmare. And I think, by the way, that's clearly why the rabbis thought you should wait 3 months before getting married. But it's also, I think, a taste of how weird it would be to be the child of somebody who died before you were born. It also shows how money ruins families. And I think that's why the rabbis wanted to protect these children and say, all things being equal, you are the children of the person who is raising you. I also think that the rabbis were probably aware that raising other people's children, especially children that you yourself had fathered from a biological point of view, and then to have to raise them for someone else, for your deceased brother, no matter how much you liked them, is really awkward. It's not what they imagined men would want to do. And they know that from Genesis 38, right? That Onan didn't want to father children that he could not have as his. that would be his brothers. And so they remove that problem. And I think that explains a lot about, again, it brings it back to the nuclear family issue, that they understand that the core unit of a family is two adults married to each other and their mutual children. And they knew there were other kinds of families. They knew there were polygamous families. They knew that there were step families. They knew that a man might marry a widow with a child and agree to support that child. But they also recognized that they wanted to create families that made sense internally, where the parents would be invested in the children and protect them and raise them. And I think they did that by changing Leverett.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a really, I think, instructive example of their approach in general. So my last question. Today, the practice of chalitza is rare, and yibum almost unheard of. That makes it difficult to relate to much of the content of this tractate. What contemporary lessons do you think these discussions have for us, and how do you suggest our listeners make it more relevant to their own lives as they slog through the tractate?
Well, I would certainly say don't try this at home. You know, I think that this is one of the reasons that I wrote my book looking at family as opposed to just Leverett. I was also advised that people aren't that interested in Leverett, which probably is the case. I'm interested in Yevamot partly because of the family issues, which I think are really central. And I think it's interesting that I know that that's the first tractate in Nashim because of the length, right? It's all based on the number of chapters in the Mishnah. But it also is a good place to start because I think that trying to figure out how families work and how individual members of the family work, you know, together or not together is really helpful for then going into the laws of marriage, divorce, etc. It is true that Leverett marriage is almost unheard of. And it is true that chalitza is rare, although there are problems in Israel, just as there are problems with husbands who refuse to give their wives a bill of divorce. There are also problems with brothers-in-law who refuse to do chalitza with their sisters-in-law again until they get paid off or whatever. So all those abuses still exist. But I think that one of the greatest things about Talmud is you never know what you're going to find. I mean, the best thing about Daf Yomi, it seems to me, because anyone who's done Daf Yomi, and I confess I haven't, knows that the bottom of the page is often not a good place to stop. And it's a very artificial, you know, distinction. But one of the things I love about going straight through a tractate, and just to show you how crazy I am right now, I'm going through Masechet Nidah, you know, one of the three impossible tractates, is that you never know what you're going to find. You think it's going to be about X, and suddenly you find yourself in the middle of a discussion about tzedakah, or, you know, about something that you never imagined you'd fall over. And the best finds in the Gemara are the ones that you're not looking for. So I think every tractate of the Talmud has something in it that speaks to us. It's just that you have to dig to find it. And, you know, that's what's great about Talmud. It's a sort of an endless quest for the interesting, sometimes the bizarre, sometimes that which is really relevant. And also recognizing that it's okay that not everything in the Talmud is relevant. Some of it wasn't relevant for the rabbis either, but they're still really interesting. I found some really wild stories in there. I'm glad I studied it.
This is definitely, you know, my personal top reason for trying to learn Daf Yomi. Rabbi Dr. Dvorah Weisberg, thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been really fun.
We can't believe we're already in Seder Nashim. We're so excited and happy to continue making this show, but due to different constraints in our own schedules, we are switching to a monthly model. We will be releasing an episode once a month going forward. Between episodes, you can keep up with Interleaved on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you heard, follow us, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and share this with your friends. Special thanks to our executive producer, Adina Karp. Come back next time for another deep dive.